Hello and welcome to Round Peg Podcast. I'm your host, Ali Barhani, geostrategy expert with Business Families Foundation and the managing director of 360 Strategic Advisors. Joining me today, all the way from Atlanta, Georgia, via Skype, is Professor Joseph Astrakhan. Joseph Astrakhan, welcome to Round Peg Podcast.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
These are testing times for all of us with COVID-19 and the pandemic climate, but it doesn't bring an excuse for me not to better introduce you, or at least quickly, for our audience today. You're a professor emeritus and past executive director at Cox Family Enterprise, at Coles College of Business, at Kennesaw State University in Georgia, where you're joining us from today via Skype, a faculty scholar at Smith Family Business Initiative at Cornell University, 2018, which is just 2 years ago, named as one of the top 25 leading scholars in entrepreneurship and small business management research, 10 books under your belt, 65 scientific publications, the list goes on, and a graduate with PhD from Yale University. But in more ways than one, I think you're a veteran of a 3.5 decades of keeping a very close look at family businesses and all things family business. How would you describe where we are today globally with everything that is going around us? And how do you see that affecting family businesses today? Is this a new era for family businesses? Are these unprecedented times of uncertainty, or family businesses in their DNAs have seen conditions like this?
Their family businesses have seen conditions like this, and there are family businesses that have witnessed the warlike conditions that we are in right now many times over. Just real briefly, I recall having a conversation. My wife and I were doing an interview with Horace Bank for family branding, and they were talking about having seen wars and absolute depressions time and time again, and saying to us, you know, the 2008-2009 crisis was very small compared to what they've lived through. And this is, again, something that family businesses are capable of taking in stride if they are like the average family business, which is a very strong balance sheet, very close family that is willing to help one another and look past individual interests for the collective good. Those are the kinds of things that allow family businesses to survive all types of disruptions, even the kind we are facing today.
Interestingly, I was passing by Fleet Street and Horace Bank headquarters in London, if we're talking about the same bank. And by just passing by, you realize that, you know, this institution or similar institutions have been around for long, as you rightly said. So you are suggesting that there is an internal compass for family businesses for uncertain times, or they have to adjust and tilt as well? Because the stewardship element about employees, about the well-being of the greater good, is really coming to a stress test, at least in living memory for some of us. Are they guided by an internal compass, you think, or it's something that they have to improvise?
And remember, there is a great diversity in family businesses. So there are some that are run, and usually the younger ones, in a way that is more self-interested, where family fights are tolerated, where the desire to get on the same page of all the owners and family members who are not owners does not exist. And those businesses will likely not survive times such as these. But the ones that are like the average family business, because remember, we're looking at these things in a somewhat statistical fashion, have an internal compass. And that internal compass, the true north of which is generations into the future. And in order to survive generations into the future, we need to be able to contend with the shocks that we face in the short term, to make the sacrifices that are necessary to survive those. And it's those sacrifices for the longer term, or what I said earlier, the collective good, that allow family businesses to survive times like these and thrive in better business and societal climates.
Well, there is very interesting development out there in terms of posturing of, you know, family businesses. Do you think, as Rahm Emanuel, who was chief of staff of Barack Obama and later mayor of Washington, if I'm not making
Chicago.
A mistake, he said to Chicago, yeah, you're absolutely right, Chicago, thank you for that. He said that a big crisis is too good of an opportunity to let go, wasted. Do you think some family businesses in times of like this will as well internally, based on their own challenges, try to go, you know, against the family grain and try to settle scores? Or do you think they unite generally, statistically? And is it more of a complex crisis management mode or thinking who's going to be ahead in the succession planning?
These are the times that define how the family will behave for generations if they have not faced times like these before. So there will be some families where people use these for selfish ends. And then there will be other families who go, let's think about this. We need to look at ourselves in terms of the longer term scope. And if we're going to stay around for a long period of time, we need to figure out how to cooperate. So let's start putting aside the differences and the struggles and the conflicts we've had. Let's look past the emotional differences that we've had and figure out how to put our family ahead of ourselves. And those families will fundamentally change or become more of who they were and survive mm-hmm. and, you know, potentially be these longer term leading type families.
Would you agree or concur or maybe refine that governments in more ways than one are a publicly listed company? And the CEO as a president is somebody that the shareholders as a nation in a majority vote elect. And there are times of underperformance or outperformance. What are the cross learnings for governments from family businesses, Joe? I mean, if anybody can reflect on that best, it would be you. Is there any learning from top family businesses? I'm not talking about, you know, the ones who are focused only on the bottom line. Are there really active learnings from family businesses and, you know, reverse osmosis to government corridors?
This is something that I've thought a little bit about, and I think there are many. And most importantly is a learning that comes from good succession. And what I mean by that is that many people believe who are in leadership positions that they are the best leader and that there should be no other leader to come after them. And because of that, they need to act in ways that may sacrifice short-term and or long-term in order to stay in a leadership position because they feel at their core they are best capable for dealing with some future crisis yet to be unnamed. And the reality of leadership is that if one has focused on good culture, if one has focused on a cooperative environment, if one has focused on the long term, then there are likely many people who can lead and lead effectively. And finding the one best leader is not as important as the leader who makes the sacrifices needed for the long term. And that may include sacrificing themselves.
But, I mean, in the overcharged political, geopolitical environment globally at the moment, do you honestly and sincerely believe that we are that blessed by having that number of global leaders ready to sacrifice themselves? I'm sitting here and scratching my bald head and saying, I don't know where is Joe said, seeing these glimmers of hope.
Your question was not what is the current state of our governmental leadership.
No, I know, but I'm leading
your
to
your question was what can governments learn from family business?
Absolutely, absolutely. But after that, I'm sitting and listening to your words of wisdom, and I'm saying, who is out there to fit that criteria?
At the current moment, there likely are not many. And we can look to the past and see some great leaders, you know, the Gandhis of the world, but we don't necessarily see them now.
You have spoken around the world in more than 35 countries. I'm still sure you've been traveling as recent as the past few weeks before everybody was grounded. Where do you think is the center of hunger for learning among family businesses? Do you see a rise of Asia and China and Asia Pacific? Because they're all mostly in first or second gen of entrepreneurs and family businesses. Do you think that they are more hungry than the Western peers, or it's the same or no difference and maturity grid? What do you think?
In my experience, and even though I've been working well in and speaking to and getting to know people in 35 plus countries, my experience would say that Central Europe has the biggest hunger.
Wow, interesting. And why is that?
I could not conclusively say, but I think there is a notion of family that allows for more communication in the environment, and that we find those kinds of families in other countries only sporadically.
Very interesting. I would never have thought about Central Europe in terms of prominence in reinforcing family businesses.
And then,
very interesting.
And then you may then the Americas. Yeah, and then Eastern parts of Eastern Europe, not all of Eastern Europe. I put Asia much further down the list in terms of real thirst for learning, and that's an overstatement because there are pockets of it where it's extremely strong. Mm-hmm. You know,
and the reason for that is what, Joe? Why they're not as hungry as their peers?
My guess is that it has to do with the pace of change. That the pace of change has been so strong and so dramatic that they haven't had time yet to focus on it, and that the families are, for many of them, much younger. And again, like I said, I don't want to be misquoted because there are lots of pockets of thirst for learning. I'm talking in broad generalities.
Okay. Among many other things, you've been on 18 boards of directors or exec, non-exec of privately owned family businesses from heavy equipment, automotive, high-tech, healthcare, pretty much across the board. What are your prognosis of, you know, there's a lot of talk that the world we will be living in after these crises will be different in more ways than one. The way we use, the way we occupy retail space, commercial space. What are your thoughts as connoisseur family businesses? And if many of these industries are disrupted, Would family businesses be at the center of some of these changes? And the reason I'm asking this is, according to Smith Family Business Initiative and an organization that is called SCORE, which you're very well familiar with, 5.5 million family-owned businesses generate 64% of the $19 trillion of U.S. GDP. So my point sitting here and raising this question is that in a post-corona world, what's going to happen to this workforce? Where are we going with it? And how would family businesses posture towards these changes?
In a post-corona world, I think things will very much be the same in terms of the family business's dominance. In fact, the studies that you just referenced were studies that I did and people quote on a regular basis.
I'm glad I did it in your presence.
The prevalence of family businesses, yeah, it's kind of a cute thing. And I think that family businesses will continue to have the upper hand in every way except perhaps two, which is family businesses that choose to remain private have slightly less access to capital, which is a double-edged sword, because in a growing environment, you grow a little bit slower. But on the other hand, in a negative environment like this one, the pressures on you are much less because you don't have thousands of shareholders who are challenging your every move in a period of time where nothing is predictable, so no challenge is is just.
Hmm. You yourself come from a family business background, and I would love you to take a few minutes to elaborate on the history of family. But as I know, a great part of it was around three industries, container and tanker shipping, which at the moment would have been challenged, coal mining, which have been frowned upon because of ESG, and pharmaceuticals, which would have been at the moment the darling of the party because of the pandemic we have. Do you think, as a secondary question to that, do you think that families who have a trilateral or multipolar type of business streams are more immune to future disruptions? Or do you think that the single pony shows are best positioned to have a longevity and go through? And on that, of course, yes, elaborate a bit more about family business and your background.
I'm happy to. Strategically thinking, and even if you just take a Darwinian perspective, if you are in an environment which is unchanging and not dynamic, you have the best chance at survival by outcompeting your neighbors by being a single pony show, as you would say. And if you're in a dynamic environment where change is happening all the time and predictability is extremely low, or the possibility that the environment will experience hiccups, meaning periods of stability followed by periods of rapid transition, then you want to be a little more diversified and have businesses that will be able to survive and some that won't. And one of the problems family businesses face, and it's generally an emotional one, is that they get emotionally attached to a business and have a hard time discontinuing the operations of a business or selling it when the environment changes. So that's one of the drawbacks, but that can be countered by really good governance. In my family business, the large one, which was actually the container shipping, oil tanking, dry bulk shipping, had also had shipbuilding, ports, and coal mines. So it was all one enterprise, whereas the pharmaceutical was a different enterprise. That was brought down by a series of events like these. And it was a listed company, so we didn't have the kind of control over its future that the family businesses that have wisely made the choice to stay private have.
So you think the sheer element of being publicly listed was the Achilles heel of the family business? And had it not been listed, you would have still been around?
No, I think it was a combination of factors. That was one of the factors.
Okay.
The family member who had built the business, who had purchased it from the ideator, founder of container shipping, Don McLean, had passed away, had no heirs. That created a dramatic amount of instability, which the listed part didn't like, and the family did not come together to protect the business. So that was the other part of it.
That brings me to my next question in a very, seamless way, and that is, you've written 10 books, and I think, would it be fair to say that most of the challenges of the family feuds and fights are in a quadrant of emotional attachment, miscommunication, lack of trust, and ego? And if you were to statistically, as a an avid follower of these trends, would give weight, is ego the biggest, killer of family businesses, or is it communication or miscommunication, trust, emotional attachment? Where would you put the center of the weight?
Well, when you put it in terms of the psychological center, it's in a lack of self-awareness at a very basic level.
Elaborate
and
on that, please.
That can manifest itself in terms of ego. It can manifest itself in terms of miscommunication. It can manifest itself in all kinds of ways. Most people, as they are raised, learn to interpret the world in ways that are incorrect. And because of the lack of desire for change, growth, and development, people often are very satisfied in looking at the world and interpreting, for example, family members in ways that are historically continuous and not in ways that are currently accurate. And it requires a lot of work to develop that kind of self-awareness where you can see your own limitations and your own biases. And if you look at a lot of the stuff that's, for example, won Nobel Prizes in the last 10 years, especially on the psychological side of economics, you'll see that most of it has to do with our own biases, which come both from how we are raised and as well our genetic predispositions. And it's very possible to get past that stuff, but you have to have a real desire to learn and grow to do so.
And that is as well somewhat correlated to organizations, think tanks, family forums. What is the role of organizations like Business Families Foundation? Do you think that entities like BFF, how can they best evolve? You know, what are the blind spots for organizations like BFF? And what would be if money was not an issue and you had a carte blanche to put the ultimate think tank or knowledge and insight development center for family businesses, what would be the characteristics of that organization?
Well, firstly, I think BFF has done an amazing job as a pioneer in the field of family education, and as well. Mm-hmm. Mostly at the behest of Nanbi Gaspé de Beaubien, as well as Philippe, to put forth the idea that one needs to have more self-awareness. So they've done a remarkable job breaking down the barriers to seeing oneself as you truly are would be the cornerstone of what I would like an organization to look like that were designed to help family businesses directly were I to be blessed with an unlimited budget. And that's really difficult to do because there are so many different routes into helping people see a need for growth and change. There's not one route. For some, it's storytelling. I remember once having a fantastic professor who loved movies. For others, it's seeing financial models. For others, it's visualizing deep into the future. So there's no one single route into these things. And yet for others, it's individualized therapy. It really depends on the person.
Is there... over the past few decades, at least, a more materialistic gaze that whatever doesn't work, we should throw more money at it. Is there a role for spirituality in the well-being and the long well-being of family businesses? I'm not talking about just mantras and meditation, but reflection and going within rather than just throwing money at challenges. It seems that our economic model in the Western world is very much whatever doesn't work, throw a fiscal policy at it. We don't stop and look at it from a more holistic point of view. Is that as well something that you are worried in family businesses or not?
You raise a very good point. And in fact, just a few months ago, we finished editing a volume of the Journal of Business Ethics, myself and several others, that looked at spirituality and religion in family business. Because there are so many amazing examples of spiritual families that have risen above the economic financials first mentality and made tremendous differences in the world. So I agree wholeheartedly with the spirit of your question.
And that would go into the institution you would put together.
Well, no doubt. And spirituality and self-awareness go hand in hand, even though some people believe it's just the opposite. The adherence to an orthodoxy is antithetical to self-awareness. On the other hand, having a sense of spirituality and connectedness to others through means that we don't know or understand, which requires some level of faith, make us more connected and more willing to look at ourselves.
Very well put. Generally, the first or second gen, they're wealth generation, then wealth preservation, then wealth accumulation, and then wealth distribution, if they are as spiritual or self-aware as you write. What is the next phase? What is after distribution? What is after generation, preservation, accumulation, distribution? What else can we do?
It's an interesting way of looking at it, and because I look at it a little bit differently.
Share it.
and this is how I've tried to raise my own children and messages that I've tried to give other families, which is first is developing individuals to be productive members of society. Second comes helping others and helping society, because without that framework, society breaks down. Third is, if you are so lucky to be able to do so, you will accumulate assets. Fourth is the proper stewardship of those assets, so that their survival and ability of those assets to be leveraged to continue to benefit society is assured. And then after that, we get to, how do we look at that in terms of long-term continuity? Who then becomes the next set of stewards, which requires developing tremendous ownership competencies. And ownership competencies and family competencies go hand in hand. And of course, part of that is the emotional relational dimension that we've mentioned much in our conversation.
Can you take a minute or two and decompose ownership and family competencies that you just touched on?
I can a little bit, but my wife wrote a paper on this recently, which is in a report for the Family Firm Institute, so that anyone who wants to go look it up can go see it.
Okay.
But family competencies include things like communication, a personal level of desire to grow and develop, understanding of family dynamics, understanding where the family would go in the long term, the role of cohesion and how to develop it, and those kinds of things. Ownership competency requires some of those same things, especially on the psychological front, but also requires some facility with financial knowledge and financial understanding. As I used to tell my students, accounting and finance are the language of business, and you cannot effectively function in the world of business unless you're well acquainted with those languages. And it also requires an understanding of strategy, et cetera, that some of the typical business disciplines. And what her research explored, I'm sorry about that.
I'm as far
away from the dog as I can get. And when he goes nuts, there's nothing I can do about it.
That's a natural touch in any conversation. I'm not going to delete it. I'm not going to edit it. Let him be in the background. Carry on.
And what I would hold is that every family member is capable of learning these things. Now, many people will say, well, why should I teach my daughter who has no interest in business, or my son who wants to be an artist? Why should I force them to learn these things? And I would say to them, as I will say to the listeners of this podcast, if you live by the ocean and you don't teach your children to swim, you are violating a moral imperative that you have, which is health and safety of your children. If you are a business owner and you have assets and wealth and responsibility, you need to teach your children the skills and lessons required to be able to swim and not drown in the wealth and responsibility of business.
Very beautiful metaphor, very powerful. A lot of times we talk about private-public partnership. Is there a new window for public family partnership? Do you think that already exists as structured? And why we refer so much to PPP but not PFP? Families are private, but is there a differentiation between these three or letters and two acronyms?
I'm not so sure. There have been many families and family businesses that have been engaged in public partnerships for many reasons. So I think that that's just a natural part of business ownership. And not doing it for the wrong reasons, but doing it for the right reasons, which is to leverage your ability to help your particular society or your particular community.
Okay. Institutions like IMD, which you're very well familiar with, have this, you know, Leading the Family Business Program, which they say it's the longest course and program for family businesses and have been around for past 30 years. But family businesses have been, you know, around since the Medicis. Isn't it a bit of a Johnny-come-lately for some of these institutions, including IMD, to claim that they are the longest course existing on family businesses, but only for the past 30 years? How come nobody was looking at family businesses at the time of Carnegie, at the time of, you know, other leading private industrial family businesses around the world?
Well, in fairness, at the time of Carnegie, there was some look at family business. Before there were business schools, and this is where the transition really happens, there were schools of commerce. There were business schools which competed with them. And the business schools were started by family businesses who needed people to work in their companies. And this was an effective way of weeding out those who would work for you and those who wouldn't. So it was also a great tool in terms of both recruiting and in terms of attaining talent. In 1920, somewhere around there, there was a review done of the early business schools, and that review said, you know, business schools are not teaching our future leaders and managers the kind of heart lessons that family businesses learn, and we need to introduce or reintroduce those into the curriculum. And that was then largely forgotten for a long period of time. This is a function of economic imperative or business strategic imperative, which states that if you want to get people to buy your product, you sell the positives and you underplay potential drawbacks. Now, if you want people to pay 100, 200,000 euros to come to a business school curriculum, you're not going to tell them go work for a family business where you probably will never make it to the very top. You want to lionize the people who have made double-digit millions in bonuses and underplay the lower-paying family businesses that, you know, basically ask their employees to be part of something larger than themselves. And there you have the history. At some point, which was post-World War II, you get business owners looking at their transitions and saying, we need help. How am I going to make this transition? And really from the marketplace itself comes the need for some type of family business education, which then we see in organizations like BFF or IMD or the many other universities around the world that have promoted family business research and education.
Do you think that sitting today on this 18th of March, 2020, the challenges for family businesses have changed? What are your three wild cards? What are your three biggest worries as disruptors? Or do you think it's business as usual for continuity of family businesses? I'm not talking about only pandemics, AI, you know, fractures in the Western financial model. What are the wild cards out there?
If you look historically, I think they're the same kinds of wild cards, maybe at a different level, characteristically, maybe a little bit different than what we've seen before, but in many ways, very similar kinds of changes. And as you look through the history of disruption and you go from basically no infrastructure to hygienic plumbing, to power being delivered directly into one's home, and I don't mean by a coal truck delivering coal to your coal bin. I mean electricity, to the very dense and easy to transport energy of hydrocarbons, to hopefully the very dense and easy to transport energy of hydrogen. These are huge advances that turned business models and societies upside down. And they're the same kinds of things that we face today. So I don't see them as being that different in terms of how families and individual humans react to change. I really don't. I know that a lot of people like to make hay with those kinds of things, as we say. I don't think they're that different. Yes, they need to be prepared for. Yes, you need to learn about them. Yes, you need to contend with them. But you also needed to do that for electricity. As you move from water power to electricity, if you said, you know, my factory runs on water power and it runs fine on water power, you were left behind. Yes, you know, and the same is with computational skills. My business runs fine on a green ledger book. I don't need to use a computer. You were left in the dust. Those things keep changing as we move forward.
Well, on that note, I have to say this is our very first round peg of podcasts in days of social distancing, self-isolation, and having a bit of family and life in the background brings a new air of novelty to this podcast session. But ever more so, Joseph, your insights, your views. So thank you for being on RoundPeg Podcast. I'm sure we will have you back and very soon on the program. Stay healthy, keep well, and thank you for joining.
Thank you for having me, and stay healthy as well. And to all the listeners out there, please do the right thing and make sure you don't contribute to the spreading of the contagion.
Thank you, Joe. You've been listening to RoundPeg Podcast, brought to you by Business Families Foundation and 360 Strategic Advisors. We hope you really liked what you heard today. You can always subscribe on Spotify, iTunes, or other platforms to hear the next conversation and our new episodes as soon as they become available.